Hello, I'm Joseph Kasser, and welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
Welcome to the deep dive. We're going to be tackling systems engineering,
right?
Which can feel a little bit like a jungle out there,
right?
With all the different definitions and approaches and all that.
Absolutely.
You've sent us a whole stack of readings.
Yes.
Including excerpts from Joseph Kasser's book,
uh-huh.
Perceptions of Systems Engineering. And we're here to be your machete and help you hack through it all.
That's right. We're hoping to give you that aha moment.
Yes.
Where you really understand not just what it is, but like why it even matters.
Yeah. And maybe spark some new questions for you too.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's unpack all this a little bit.
Okay.
From what I'm seeing in the table of contents and the excerpts you've highlighted,
uh-huh.
Kasser really goes deep, covering everything from like the historical roots of the field.
Yeah.
To modern trends like model-based systems engineering, or MBSE.
One thing that immediately jumps out at you,
yeah,
is how Kasser approaches the challenge of defining systems engineering itself.
Okay.
He doesn't just give like one right answer.
Right.
He actually shows us all these different schools of thought within the field.
Interesting.
It's like he's saying, hey, this isn't just a checklist.
Yeah.
This is like a way of thinking.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So instead of just one right answer, there are different like camps within systems engineering.
Exactly.
What are some examples of how they differ?
So some of them are really big on problem solving, you know, breaking those complex challenges into smaller manageable parts.
Okay.
Others are super into the process, you know, standardized procedures,
right,
making sure everything's consistent and efficient.
Okay.
And then there are those who are all about the human element.
Okay.
Recognizing that systems are built by and for people.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So different perspectives on how to approach complex systems.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. But this idea of systems engineering being a way of thinking, how would you explain that to someone who's like completely new to it?
That's a great question. It's about shifting your focus away from the individual components to understanding how those components work together.
Okay.
And contribute to a larger whole.
So seeing the big picture and how it all fits together.
Yeah. So imagine you're building a car.
Okay.
A mechanic might be super focused on fixing the engine.
Right.
But a systems engineer is thinking about how that engine works with the transmission.
Okay.
The wheels, the brakes, the driver, all of it.
Right.
To make sure the car runs smoothly and safely.
Okay. So it's really about seeing that big picture and understanding how all the pieces fit together.
Exactly.
And you mentioned this applies to more than just traditional engineering, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like what?
You'd be surprised to hear that Kasser uses the example of optimizing your sex life.
Really?
To demonstrate systems engineering principles.
Wow.
Yeah, he emphasizes that it's all about optimizing a whole system, not just the individual parts, whether we're talking about spaceships, a city's traffic flow,
right,
or even your personal life.
Okay, I'm not going to forget that analogy anytime soon.
It's a good one.
It really highlights how systems thinking can apply to anything.
Yeah.
Okay, speaking of unexpected, one of the things that really stood out to me in these readings was Kasser's argument that we may be overemphasizing requirements.
Oh, that's a key takeaway.
In systems engineering.
Yeah, and it might seem counterintuitive.
Right.
Because, you know, traditionally systems engineering has put so much emphasis on, you know,
right,
defining every little requirement up front.
Right.
But Kasser suggests that this can actually cause problems.
I'm curious to hear more about that. Why would focusing on requirements be a bad thing?
Sure.
Isn't it important to be specific about what we want to achieve?
Of course, you need clarity.
Yeah.
But Kasser argues that without a clear vision of the desired outcome, you might end up solving the wrong problem altogether.
Oh.
Yeah, he calls this desired outcome the KONO PS.
Okay.
It stands for Concept of Operations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the KONO PS is kind of like the North Star, the guiding vision of what you're trying to achieve.
Exactly. It's about defining the what before getting lost in the how.
Okay.
And Kasser suggests that starting with a strong KONO PS can lead to way better solutions.
Makes sense.
More adaptable systems and ultimately less wasted effort.
Yeah, chasing down irrelevant requirements.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. Because if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there.
Exactly.
But how does this KONO PS first approach differ from the traditional way of doing things?
Well, he compares working without a clear KONO PS to Deming's red bead experiment.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of that?
I don't think so.
It's this classic demonstration of how seemingly human errors can be rooted in a flawed system.
Interesting.
So imagine this factory where workers have to pick out red beads from a bowl of mixed beads.
Okay.
No matter how hard they try, they always end up with some red beads
Yeah.
because the system itself is designed to produce errors.
Oh, so even with like the best of intentions, the outcome is predetermined.
Yeah, by the
Okay.
system.
I see how this relates to systems engineering.
Right.
If you don't have that clear cone OPS, you could be setting yourself up for failure, no
Exactly.
matter how detailed your requirements are.
That's the takeaway.
Okay.
So Kasser advocates for what he calls the A paradigm,
Okay.
which prioritizes the cone OPS.
Right.
The traditional approach focused on upfront requirements.
Yeah.
He calls that the B paradigm,
Yeah.
and he gives really strong arguments for why A can lead to more effective and adaptable systems.
That makes a lot of sense. This idea of A versus B is really interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a specific example from the book that shows how this plays out in a real-world situation?
Yeah, he uses this case study of a satellite ground system replacement project at NASA to
Oh,
illustrate this.
okay.
So the team initially was focused on meeting all these detailed requirements, but they ran into problems because they hadn't really defined the overall purpose and goals
Right.
of the new system.
Right, so they had all the technical details figured out, not that overarching vision.
Exactly. And it wasn't until they stepped back
Yeah.
and developed a strong cone OPS
Right.
that they were able to create a solution that really met the needs of the users
Okay.
and the mission.
So having that strong cone OPS can keep a project on track and achieving its purpose.
It's about making sure you're building the right thing, not just building the thing right, which
Right.
is fundamental to systems engineering.
And that applies to so many areas of life,
Yeah,
not just engineering.
absolutely.
Speaking of different perspectives, Kasser also talks about different types of systems engineers, right?
He identifies five distinct types,
Five types.
each with their own strengths and preferred ways of working.
That's fascinating. It sounds like there's a lot more to being a systems engineer than meets the eye.
Oh, for sure.
What are some of the key differences between these types?
Well, you've got your classic problem solvers,
Okay.
the ones who love those complex challenges. They come up with elegant solutions.
Right.
They're analytical,
Okay.
detail-oriented.
So they love the nuts and bolts of a system.
They love it.
Okay.
And then you've got your process gurus,
Okay.
all about efficiency and consistency,
Right.
making sure things are delivered on time and on budget.
So they're the ones making sure the trains run on time.
Precisely.
Okay. What else?
Then we got the big picture thinkers.
Okay.
They can see the forest for the trees,
Right.
less concerned with the little details and more focused on the goals and objectives.
Right.
They excel at the strategic planning,
Okay.
connecting all the different parts.
So they're kind of like the architect designing a building.
That's a great analogy.
Okay, cool.
Then you've got the people-centric engineers. They recognize that systems are ultimately created by and for humans.
Right.
They're really good at understanding user needs,
Okay.
designing intuitive interfaces.
So they make sure the technology actually works for the people who use it.
Exactly. They bridge the gap
That's really important.
between the technical and the human.
Okay.
And finally, you got your integrators.
Okay.
They're the ones that bring all the pieces together. Master collaborators.
Right.
They can work effectively with different types of engineers, stakeholders, disciplines,
Right.
to make sure everything comes together successfully.
That sounds like a diverse and talented group.
It is.
Do you identify with any of these types?
I find myself drawn to the problem solving and
Yeah.
big picture thinking. But honestly, I think the best systems engineers blend elements from all five types.
That makes sense.
Recognizing your strengths, but also being willing to collaborate and learn from others who have different skills and
Right.
perspectives.
So it's about realizing that no one person has all the answers.
Exactly.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Yes.
Okay. Now, as we continue our deep dive, I want to ask you about a term that came up a lot in the readings.
Yeah.
Model-based systems engineering, or MBSE.
Ah,
MBSE,
yes.
it's been a hot topic
It has.
in the field for a while now.
And for good reason.
From what I gather, it involves using models to represent different aspects of a system
Right.
throughout its life cycle.
Yeah.
But I'm still a bit fuzzy on what that means in practice.
Okay, so think of it this way.
Okay.
Traditionally, systems engineering has relied heavily on documents,
Yeah.
right?
Requirements, documents, design
It's
documents.
test plans and so on.
Right.
But with MBSE,
Yeah.
we shift to using models
Okay.
as the primary means of communication and collaboration.
So instead of just writing about the system, you're creating these visual representations.
Exactly. Like yeah. And these models can capture all sorts of different perspectives of the system, like its behavior, its structure, its interactions with the environment.
Interesting.
And what's really cool about MBSE is that these models aren't just static pictures.
Right.
They're dynamic and interconnected. So engineers can simulate the system's performance. Analyze different design options, identify potential problems.
So you can test things out virtually before building the actual physical system.
Exactly.
That sounds pretty powerful.
It is one of the key benefits.
Yep. Yeah.
MBSE can also improve communication because everyone is working from a shared understanding represented in the models.
So it reduces ambiguity and makes sure everyone's on the same page.
Exactly.
Okay, this all sounds incredibly beneficial. Is MBSE a totally new way of thinking about systems engineering?
I would say it's more of an evolution than a revolution.
Okay.
A lot of the core concepts of MBSE are rooted in those traditional systems engineering practices.
Right.
But MBSE leverages the power of computers and modeling to take these concepts to a new level.
Okay.
So it's a more efficient, integrated, and collaborative approach.
So it's taking the best of what we've learned and amplifying it with technology.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's important to remember that MBSE is more than just software tools.
Right.
It's a shift in mindset. A way of thinking about systems holistically and using those models as the main means of communication.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's not just about the technology, but about how we use it to enhance our understanding and management of complex systems.
Exactly.
Well, I have to say, this deep dive has given me a whole new appreciation for systems engineering.
Me too. It's fascinating stuff.
We've covered so much already.
We have.
You know, different approaches to defining systems engineering. The importance of that comma PS.
Right.
The different types of systems engineers.
Yeah.
And now this really fascinating concept of MBSE.
It's a lot to take in.
Before we move on, I want to take a little pause here.
Okay.
And recap what we've learned so far.
Sounds good.
So we've established that systems engineering is all about taking that holistic view.
Right.
It's not limited to traditional engineering disciplines.
Nope.
You know, you can apply systems thinking to anything from traffic flow to, even optimizing your sex life.
As Kasser would say.
And we've learned that starting with a clear Kono PS is crucial.
Yes.
For setting the right direction and avoiding wasted effort.
Absolutely.
Kasser's A versus B paradigm really helped solidify that point for me.
It's a helpful framework.
We've also explored those different types of systems engineers, each with their own strengths and perspectives, highlighting the importance of collaboration.
Sure, sure.
And realizing no one person has all the answers.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
And then there's MBSE.
Yeah.
Which takes those traditional systems engineering principles.
Uh-huh.
And enhances them with the power of modeling and simulation.
It's all about a more integrated and collaborative approach.
Now, for you listening, I want to leave you with this thought.
Okay.
We've seen how systems thinking can be applied to tons of different situations.
Yeah.
What are some areas in your own life where you could benefit from a more systems-oriented approach?
I like that.
It could be anything from managing a project at work to planning a family vacation.
Right.
Keep that question in mind as we continue our deep dive.
Sounds good. Welcome back. We're continuing our exploration of systems engineering through Joseph Kasser's perceptions of systems engineering. Last time, we talked about different approaches to defining the field and the importance of starting with a clear concept of operations, or Kono PS. Now, let's dive into how Kasser views the entire life cycle of a system.
You're talking about that journey a system takes from, like, its initial spark of an idea all the way to its eventual retirement.
Exactly.
I'm curious to see how this fits in with Kasser's more holistic approach that we've been discussing.
Well, Kasser presents this really interesting framework called the 9-system model.
Okay.
It breaks down the life cycle into 9 interconnected systems.
9.
Yeah. And it's not like a simple linear progression from one phase to the next.
Okay.
It really emphasizes the relationships and dependencies between these different systems.
So it's more like a web than a straight line.
Exactly. Yeah. More like a web.
That definitely feels more in line with the complexity we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Can you walk me through these 9 systems?
Sure.
I'm eager to see how they all fit together.
Let's start with the reason why we even embark on this systems engineering journey in the first place.
Okay.
Kasser calls this the undesirable situation.
Okay.
It's that problem we're trying to solve, the need we're trying to fulfill.
So it's like the starting point.
Yes, the spark that ignites the whole process.
What comes next?
From there, we move to envisioning a better future.
Okay.
Kasser calls this the feasible, conceptual, future desirable situation, or FCFDS for short.
FCFDS, that's a mouthful.
It is.
So it's like painting a picture of that ideal scenario.
Exactly.
Problem solved, need met.
Yeah. And it's important to note that the FCFDS itself is considered a system in Kasser's model.
Interesting.
It represents the context in which our solution will operate.
Okay.
Then we have the process of planning how to transition from the problem to the solution. And the process of actually making that transition happen,
gotcha.
Those are systems 4 and 5 in the model.
So we've got the problem, the desired outcome, and the processes for getting there.
Right.
Where does the actual solution fit into all of this?
That's system number 6, the solution system itself.
Okay.
The star of the show.
Right.
The system we're designing and building to address that undesirable situation and bring about our FCFDS.
Okay, so we're more than halfway through the model now.
We are.
What are the remaining 3 systems?
So we also have the process of verifying that our solution is actually working.
Okay.
As intended. And this isn't just about testing in a lab.
Right.
Kasser emphasizes that verification should happen in the real world.
Makes sense. A system that works perfectly in a controlled environment might behave differently out in the real world.
Exactly.
With all its complexities.
Exactly. You got it.
Okay.
Then there's the created situation.
Okay.
The reality that emerges once our solution system is in place. This might not always perfectly align with our initial vision.
Right.
Because, you know, unforeseen factors can come into play.
So it's about acknowledging that we can't predict everything.
Right.
And being prepared to adapt as needed.
You got it.
Okay.
And finally, we have the organizations involved.
Right.
The entities responsible for developing, implementing, and using the system.
Okay.
This includes everyone from the engineers and project managers to the end users and stakeholders.
So that's like Kasser saying systems don't exist in a vacuum.
Exactly.
They're part of a larger ecosystem with all these interconnected elements.
It's all about understanding those connections.
That we need to consider.
Yeah, and dependencies.
Right.
And considering how each system influences the others.
This 9-system model can be a really powerful tool.
It is.
For navigating that complexity.
It is. And here's another key point.
Okay.
This model can be applied at different levels.
Okay.
Within a system.
Uh-huh.
So you could use it to map out the overall life cycle.
Right.
Of a large complex system like an aircraft.
Okay.
And then zoom in and use the same model.
Yeah.
To understand a subsystem like the navigation system.
So it's a framework that can be scaled to fit the situation.
Exactly.
That's really useful.
It is.
I can also see how this model could help bridge the gap between those different camps of thought within systems engineering we talked about earlier.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
By providing a common framework,
yeah,
it allows different perspectives to be integrated and understood in relation to each other.
Right.
So the problem solvers, the process gurus, the big picture thinkers, they can all see how their contributions fit into the larger system life cycle.
It's like speaking a shared language.
Exactly.
Which is so crucial.
It is.
When you're dealing with something as complex as systems engineering.
For sure.
Now let's shift gears a bit and talk about stakeholders.
Okay.
They play a critical role in a system's life cycle. But managing their expectations and keeping everyone happy.
Right.
Can be a real challenge.
It can.
Does Kasser offer any insights on this front?
He does. He uses a real-world case study to show how the 9-system model can be used to effectively manage stakeholder expectations.
Oh, interesting. Tell me more.
He talks about the MCSS replacement project.
Okay.
At NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center.
Right.
This project involved upgrading a critical data switching system.
Okay.
That was used for managing multiple satellite operations.
So we're talking about a high-stakes situation where a lot of people were relying on this system to function properly.
Very high stakes.
I imagine there were a ton of different stakeholders with various concerns and priorities.
Oh, tons. Oh. Kasser highlights how the project team used the 9-system model to identify all the stakeholders and really understand their individual areas of concern.
Okay.
This went beyond the obvious stakeholders, like the engineers and project managers.
Yeah.
They also considered those who might not be directly involved in the technical side, but would still be impacted by the system. Like the users, the operators, even external organizations relying on the data.
So it's about recognizing that a system's impact extends far beyond its immediate technical boundaries.
Yes.
And thinking about all the people who will be affected by it in some way.
Exactly. And by mapping out those stakeholders within the 9-system model, the project team could better understand their concerns.
Right.
And ensure they were addressed throughout the life cycle.
That makes a lot of sense.
They held meetings with each stakeholder group.
Okay.
To discuss the proposed upgrade, gather feedback.
Okay.
On potential issues and brainstorm solutions together.
This sounds like a really proactive approach to communication and collaboration.
It was.
Rather than just dictating what's going to happen.
They wanted to involve everyone.
Did they encounter any resistance or pushback from stakeholders during this process?
Of course there were challenges.
Yeah.
But by engaging with stakeholders early and often, being transparent about the project's goals, timelines, and potential risks,
okay,
and actively seeking their input on key decisions,
yeah,
they were able to build trust and address concerns
right
before they escalated into major problems.
It's like they were inviting stakeholders to be part of the solution.
Yes.
Rather than just dictating what was going to happen.
Exactly.
That seems like such a valuable lesson.
It is.
Not just for engineering projects, but for anything involving collaboration and change management.
It's all about building relationships.
Yeah.
And recognizing that stakeholders can be valuable allies.
Absolutely.
In achieving success.
And here's another example of how the 9-system model came in handy for this project.
Okay.
Kasser points out how the team used it to develop a robust transition plan.
Yeah.
That roadmap for moving from the existing system to the new one.
Right.
This is where things can get really tricky.
They can.
Especially when you're dealing with critical systems that can't afford any downtime.
Absolutely.
How did they manage that transition without disrupting those ongoing satellite operations?
That's where the model's emphasis on interconnectedness really paid off.
Okay.
Using the 9-system model, they identified 11 different MSOCC systems.
Okay.
Think of them as supporting systems.
Yeah.
That could potentially be temporarily removed to accommodate the installation of the new system.
Okay.
It was like a giant puzzle.
Right.
Where they had to figure out how to swap out a key piece without disrupting the overall picture.
Wow. So they were thinking strategically about the impact of each step in the transition process.
Very strategically.
And they managed to pull it off without any hiccups?
Well, they recognized that no loss of data didn't necessarily mean no downtime.
Uh-huh.
They knew there would be brief periods when no data was being received.
Okay.
And they used those windows to reroute data sources and sinks.
Right.
From the old system to the new one.
Okay.
It was a carefully choreographed dance.
Wow.
But by planning and coordinating each step meticulously,
yeah,
they successfully completed the upgrade with minimal disruption.
That's impressive.
It was a huge accomplishment.
It highlights how a structured approach to systems engineering like the 9-system model
right
can be really helpful when navigating these complex transitions.
Absolutely. Now let's move on to another key aspect of Kasser's approach.
Okay.
His guidelines for creating a system.
Right.
He offers 8 specific guidelines.
Okay.
Starting with examining the undesirable situation from multiple perspectives.
Okay.
Remember those different camps of thought within systems engineering we talked about?
Yeah.
This is where that comes into play.
So it's about bringing those diverse viewpoints to the table.
Exactly.
And not getting stuck in one way of thinking.
And he advocates for going beyond traditional systems thinking tools.
Okay.
Like causal loop diagrams.
Yeah.
And system dynamics models to include perspectives from what he calls the generic and continuum perspectives.
Okay, now you're throwing some technical terms at me.
I am.
Can you break those down a bit?
Sure. The generic perspective involves looking for similarities and differences between the current situation and other systems, even those outside the specific domain you're working in.
Yeah.
It's about asking questions like, have we encountered similar problems before?
Right.
What worked?
Yeah.
What didn't?
So it's about drawing on past experiences
right
and looking for patterns that might apply to the current situation.
And the continuum perspective focuses on understanding how the system changes over time.
Okay.
And under different conditions,
uh-huh,
it involves asking questions like, how will the system evolve in the future?
Right.
What are the potential trade-offs and unintended consequences?
So it's about taking a long-term view.
Yes.
And recognizing that systems are dynamic.
Exactly, not static.
Okay, so by combining these different perspectives,
oh, yeah,
we get a more holistic understanding of the problem.
Yes.
And avoid jumping to conclusions.
Exactly. It's like gathering all the pieces of a puzzle
yeah
before you try to put it together.
What's the next guideline in Kasser's framework?
The second guideline emphasizes understanding the situation.
Oh, cool.
For trying to solve it.
Right.
This involves researching the application domain,
uh-huh,
gathering data,
okay,
talking to stakeholders,
yeah,
really digging into the root causes of the problem.
It's like a doctor diagnosing a patient.
Exactly.
They don't just treat the symptoms.
Right.
They run tests.
Right.
Ask questions and try to understand the underlying condition.
It's about getting to the heart of the matter.
Right.
Not just applying a Band-Aid solution.
That makes sense. What's the next step?
Once you have a solid understanding of the problem, Kasser says the next step is to create a clear vision of the desired outcome.
Okay.
That FCFDS we talked about earlier.
Uh-huh.
And he provides a really useful framework for doing this.
Okay.
Using what he calls the 8 descriptive HTPs.
HTPS, what are those?
They stand for holistic thinking perspectives.
Okay.
Remember how we talked about systems engineering being a way of thinking? Well, these perspectives help us approach a problem from different angles to make sure we're considering all the relevant factors.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Uh-huh.
What are these 8 perspectives?
Well, first, there's the big picture perspective, which is about stepping back, considering the overall context and goals of the system.
Okay.
Then there's the operational perspective.
Okay.
Which focuses on how the system will be used and operated in the real world.
Okay.
The functional perspective breaks down the system's functions and how they interact with each other.
So we're looking at the what, the how and the why of the system.
Exactly.
What other perspectives are there?
The structural perspective examines the physical components and how they're organized.
Gotcha.
The generic perspective, which we discussed earlier,
involves
comparing the system to similar systems to identify patterns and potential solutions.
Okay.
The continuum perspective, also mentioned earlier, explores how the system changes over time and under different conditions.
So far, we've covered the big picture, the operations, the functions, the structure, the similarities to other systems, and how it evolves over time.
Exactly.
What are the last two?
The quantitative perspective focuses on measuring and analyzing the system's performance using metrics and data.
Gotcha.
And finally, the temporal perspective considers the timing and sequencing of events.
Wow, that's a lot to consider.
It is.
But it makes sense that by taking all of those different perspectives into account, you can create a much more comprehensive and well-rounded FCFDS.
It's about making sure we're not just solving the problem, but solving it in a way that aligns with our overall goals, values, and constraints.
This approach could be really valuable for tackling complex challenges in any field.
Oh, absolutely.
Not just engineering.
It's a universal framework.
What's the next guideline?
The fourth guideline focuses on managing complexity through hierarchies.
Okay.
This involves breaking down the system into smaller, more manageable chunks.
Okay.
Think of it like organizing a messy room.
Right.
You create categories and subcategories to make sense of the chaos.
So it's about creating a structured approach to dealing with all those moving parts.
Exactly. And by abstracting out unnecessary details and focusing on the key elements that are relevant to the problem, we can avoid getting overwhelmed by complexity.
It's like focusing on the forest.
Yes.
Instead of getting lost in the trees.
Exactly.
What's the next step?
Kasser's fifth guideline advises us to filter out those aspects of the situation that are not pertinent to the problem at hand.
Okay.
This involves drawing clear system boundaries, focusing on the elements that are within our control and influence.
It's about being strategic about where we focus our efforts and energy.
Exactly.
We can't solve every problem in the world.
Right.
So we need to be clear about what's within our scope.
It's about recognizing that we can't control everything.
Right.
And focusing on what we can influence.
What's next?
His sixth guideline involves partitioning the FCFDS into what he calls the system of interest. Our solution system.
Okay.
And its adjacent systems.
Okay.
This is where we start to get specific about what we're building.
Right.
And how it interacts with its surroundings.
So it's like drawing a line in the sand.
Exactly.
And saying, this is what we're responsible for,
right,
and these are the other systems we need to consider.
It's about understanding the boundaries of our solution and how it interacts with the larger world.
It's like planning a party, right? You need to think about who you're inviting, how they'll interact with each other, and what kind of environment you want to create.
Exactly.
And just like with a party,
those
adjacent systems can either enhance or disrupt the overall experience.
That's a great analogy.
And that leads us to Kasser's seventh guideline, which focuses on optimizing the interfaces between these systems.
This involves ensuring they work together smoothly, effectively, considering things like data formats, communication protocols, and physical connections.
It's like building a bridge between two islands.
Okay.
You need to make sure that bridge is strong,
yeah,
stable, and allows for smooth passage between the two sides.
Exactly. It's about creating seamless connections,
yeah,
between the different parts of the system.
This all sounds incredibly thorough and well thought out.
Kasser is very thorough.
What's the final guideline?
His 8th and final guideline emphasizes recognizing those don't care situations we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
This involves identifying those aspects of a system that, while they might seem important at first glance, don't actually impact its core functionality.
So it's about letting go of the need for absolute control.
Yes.
And being willing to embrace some flexibility.
Exactly. It's about focusing on the essentials. Avoiding unnecessary complexity.
And Kasser provides a rather unexpected example.
He does.
To illustrate this point.
Uh-huh.
Optimizing your sex life.
Yes. Optimizing your sex life.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting.
It does.
Tell me more.
So he starts by applying those holistic thinking perspectives we discussed earlier.
Okay.
To examine the current situation.
Uh-huh.
This involves considering things like your desires, your partner's desires,
right,
the frequency and quality of your interactions,
right,
and any external factors that might be impacting your sex life.
It's like doing a relationship checkup.
Exactly.
Identifying the strengths, weaknesses, and areas for improvement.
Precisely. Then he guides us to create a vision of a better future.
Okay.
A feasible, conceptual, future, desirable sex life, if you will.
I love that.
This involves imagining what an ideal sex life would look like for you and your partner,
mm-hmm,
considering factors like frequency, intimacy, pleasure, and communication.
It's about setting goals and aspirations,
right,
for what you want to achieve together.
Exactly. Yeah. And just like with any system, those goals need to be realistic and achievable.
Absolutely.
Then he encourages us to identify those aspects of our sex life,
okay,
that we don't care about.
Uh-huh.
This might involve letting go of certain expectations,
right,
or being more flexible in our approach.
So it's about recognizing that perfection is often the enemy of good.
It is.
Sometimes it's better to embrace spontaneity and imperfection,
right,
rather than getting bogged down and trying to control every detail.
And finally, he highlights the importance of communication and feedback.
Yeah.
In optimizing our sex life.
Right.
This involves talking openly and honestly with our partner,
uh-huh,
about our desires, our needs, and what's working and what's not.
It's about creating a feedback loop.
Exactly.
Just like with any system, we need to be able to adjust and adapt,
right,
based on the information we're receiving.
This example might seem lighthearted.
It is a little.
But it powerfully demonstrates how systems engineering principles can be applied to any aspect of our lives.
Absolutely.
It's a reminder that systems thinking is a valuable tool for anyone navigating complexity.
Totally agree.
Whether we're designing a spaceship, improving a business process,
mm-hmm,
or even enhancing our personal relationships.
It's about taking a step back, seeing the bigger picture.
Right.
And understanding how all the pieces fit together.
Exactly.
This has been an incredibly insightful exploration.
It has.
Of Kasser's framework for creating a system.
It's a powerful framework.
I'm already starting to see how these principles could be applied to so many different challenges.
They can be applied to almost anything.
And remember, we've only just scratched the surface of what Kasser covers in his book.
Yeah.
I know, I can't wait to dive into the rest.
Me too.
But before we move on to part 3, I want to leave our listeners with a thought to ponder.
Okay.
We've talked about how important it is to understand the undesirable situation,
right,
the context,
right,
the stakeholders,
yeah,
and the desired outcome.
Absolutely.
But we've also touched on the importance of letting go.
Yes.
Of those don't care situations.
Those are important.
Those things that might seem important,
right,
but don't actually contribute to the overall success of the system.
Exactly.
Think about this in your own life.
Good point.
What are you holding on to that might be categorized as a don't care?
That's a good question.
Could letting go of those things free up your energy and attention for what truly matters?
I like that.
Keep that question in mind as we continue our deep dive into perceptions of systems engineering.
Sounds good.
Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into perceptions of systems engineering. We've covered a lot of ground exploring Kasser's unique perspective on defining the field, understanding the system life cycle, and his framework for creating a system. Now, I'm excited to dig into some of those nuanced ideas he brings up that really make you think differently about systems engineering.
Yeah, Kasser definitely doesn't shy away from challenging conventional wisdom. He dedicates a good chunk of his book to highlighting some of the paradoxes and often overlooked aspects of systems engineering.
Okay.
And one of the most fascinating concepts he presents is this idea of don't care situations.
Yeah, we touched on this a little bit earlier.
We did.
But I'm still wrapping my head around it.
It's a tricky one.
It seems counterintuitive to like intentionally ignore certain aspects of a system.
Right.
Especially when we're talking about complex engineering projects.
It goes against that instinct to be thorough, to try and account for every possible variable.
Yeah.
But Kasser argues that by identifying those aspects of a system that we truly don't care about, meaning they don't significantly impact the core function, we can actually create more adaptable and robust systems.
Okay, so it's about being strategic with our focus.
Exactly.
Not getting bogged down in details that don't really matter in the grand scheme of things.
Precisely. It's about recognizing that sometimes overspecifying can lead to more problems than it solves.
Do you have like a real world example of this don't care principle in action?
Oh, yeah.
Something that would help me understand how it works in practice.
Absolutely. Kasser uses a case study from his work on the Luz solar electric power generating system.
Okay.
They had this issue with glue that was used on a sun sensor.
Okay.
And over time, this glue became opaque, which interfered with the sensor's performance.
Not good.
Now, during the design phase, they could have specified the exact type of glue to be used down to its chemical composition.
Right, which seems like the thorough approach, making sure every detail is accounted for.
Right, but here's the thing.
Okay.
Specifying whether or not glue was allowed on a certain part of the sensor wouldn't have actually affected the system's overall performance.
Oh, wow.
It was a don't care situation.
So by trying to be super specific,
they
actually introduced an unnecessary constraint that made the system more vulnerable to failure.
And it ended up leading to costly replacements down the line.
Oh, wow.
Because the glue they did use caused problems.
Wow, that's a good lesson.
It is.
Sometimes the simplest solution is the best one.
Often.
And by focusing on those essential requirements and leaving some room for flexibility.
Yes.
In areas that don't really impact the functionality, you can create systems that are not only effective, but also more adaptable to change and unexpected events.
Absolutely. Now, shifting gears a bit.
Okay.
Kasser also spends a lot of time discussing the evolution of systems engineering.
Yeah.
He points out that the field arose during the Cold War to handle increasingly complex technology.
Right.
But it's certainly not limited to rocket science anymore.
Right. And we've talked about this, how systems thinking can apply to so many different fields.
To almost anything.
It's really fascinating to think about how the field has expanded beyond that initial scope.
And that evolution has naturally led to different schools of thought within systems engineering, each with its own perspective on what the discipline is and how it should be practiced. And what's great is that Kasser doesn't shy away from these differences.
Yeah.
He embraces them.
It seems like he's saying that disagreement and debate can be healthy.
It can.
It's the field.
Yes.
It pushes us to think critically and refine our understanding.
By exploring these different perspectives.
Right.
And recognizing their strengths and weaknesses.
Uh-huh.
We gain a more nuanced understanding of systems engineering as a whole.
That reminds me of something else Kasser brings up.
Yeah.
The relationship between systems engineering and other disciplines.
Okay.
Like project management.
Right.
He points out that there's often overlap and even tension between these fields.
Makes sense.
Yeah, right.
In the real world, these disciplines are constantly interacting.
Right. You can't really have effective systems engineering without good project management.
And vice versa.
But I can also see how those interactions could lead to conflict.
They can.
If the roles and responsibilities aren't clearly defined.
That's exactly Kasser's point.
Okay.
He offers some great insights into how to navigate these relationships.
Yep.
Emphasizing clear communication.
Right.
Collaboration and mutual understanding.
It's about recognizing that both disciplines have something to offer.
Yes.
And finding ways to work together effectively.
It's like a partnership.
Yes.
Where each party brings their unique skills and perspectives.
Achieve a common goal.
Exactly. And speaking of challenging conventions.
Yes.
Kasser even suggests that the traditional emphasis on requirements in systems engineering might need a little rethinking.
Didn't we talk about this?
We did.
About how starting with a strong concept of operations.
Right.
That Canoa PS.
Yes.
Might be more effective than jumping straight into detailed requirements.
So got it.
Okay.
And that ties into his critique of what he calls the B paradigm.
Okay.
Which focuses on those upfront requirements versus the A paradigm, which prioritizes developing a clear cone FPS first. He argues that by focusing on the desired outcome, what we want to achieve, we can avoid getting bogged down in irrelevant requirements and create systems that actually meet the needs of the users.
It's like having a destination in mind.
Yes.
Before you start planning your trip.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you might end up somewhere you didn't want to go.
That's a great analogy.
So this A versus B paradigm is really making me rethink how I approach problem solving in general.
It's a powerful framework.
It's so easy to get caught up in the details without considering the bigger picture.
It's a common trap.
It is. Now, speaking of shifting paradigms,
okay.
Kasser also introduces the concept of model-based systems engineering, or MBSE.
Yes, MBSE, a hot topic in the field.
It was a hot topic in those readings you sent me.
It's a powerful approach.
It seems like it.
Yeah.
But I'm still trying to understand what it actually means in practice.
So think of it this way.
Okay.
Traditionally, systems engineering has relied heavily on documents to capture information about a system. Requirements, documents, design documents, test plans, and so on.
Right.
But with MBSE,
we
shift to using models
as
the primary means of communication and collaboration.
So instead of just writing about the system, we're creating these visual representations that everyone can understand.
And these models can capture different perspectives of the system, its behavior, its structure, its interactions with the environment.
Okay.
But here's the key difference.
With that?
These models aren't just static documents.
Right.
They're dynamic and interconnected.
Okay.
So engineers can simulate the system's performance, analyze different design options, identify potential problems early on.
Right. So you can test things out virtually.
Exactly.
Before actually building anything.
It's incredibly useful for managing complexity.
Yeah.
And reducing the risk of costly errors.
It's like having a virtual blueprint.
It is.
Of the system.
Yes.
That everyone can interact with.
And under
MBSE can also really improve communication among stakeholders.
Oh, absolutely.
Because everyone's working from that shared understanding represented in the models.
It reduces ambiguity and ensures everyone's on the same page.
It sounds like a win-win.
It is.
Would you say that MBSE is a totally new way of thinking about systems engineering?
I would say it's an evolution, not a revolution.
Okay.
Many of the core concepts are rooted in traditional systems engineering practices.
Uh-huh.
But by leveraging the power of computing and modeling, MBSE takes those concepts to a new level.
So it's about taking the best of what we've learned and amplifying it with modern technology.
Exactly.
And tools.
And it's important to remember that MBSE is more than just software tools.
Right.
It's a shift in mindset.
Okay.
Thinking about systems holistically, leveraging those models as the primary means of communication and analysis.
Okay, so this has been a really insightful exploration of MBSE.
It is fascinating stuff.
Now, before we wrap up our deep dive, I want to highlight one more concept from Kasser's book that really stood out to me.
Okay, what's that?
This idea of satisficing versus satisfying in systems engineering.
Ah, yes, that's an important distinction.
So often people want that absolute best solution.
Right.
The one that optimizes every single criteria.
Exactly.
But Kasser points out that in the real world, this can be incredibly difficult, if not impossible.
It can be.
To achieve.
Because there are always constraints and trade-offs and unforeseen challenges.
Right.
So satisficing is about recognizing those limitations and finding a solution that's good enough.
Yeah.
One that meets those critical criteria
without
getting bogged down in the pursuit of an unattainable, perfect solution.
So it's about being pragmatic.
Exactly.
And making the best decision with the information and resources available to you.
Precisely. It's a valuable reminder that sometimes we need to let go of perfectionism and embrace good enough to move forward.
This satisficing concept really resonates with me.
Yeah, it's a good one.
We can all get caught up in striving for perfection.
We can.
Whether it's in our work or personal lives.
Absolutely.
It's a good reminder that sometimes good enough is actually well good enough.
Done is better than perfect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, this deep dive into perceptions of systems engineering has been eye-opening.
It has been a fascinating journey.
I feel like I have a much deeper understanding of the field, its complexities, and its potential.
Me too.
And for you listening, I hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity and given you some new insights to ponder.
I hope so.
We encourage you to keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep those don't care situations in mind.
Those are important.
You might be surprised how much simpler and effective your solutions can be.
Yeah.
When you focus on what truly matters.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of systems engineering.
Until next time.
I hope you enjoyed today's deep dive. Why not take a moment and join the discussion in the LinkedIn group tackling complex problems. Take care.